Well, good morning. This is Per Fagring, and I am hosting the Friday call-in show today. And we have a special guest, economics professor Richard Wolff, who wrote Capitalism Hits the Fan, and his latest one is Occupy the Economy, Challenging Capitalism. Richard Wolff, welcome to KBOO.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
Okay, well, there's lots going on in the economics world. LIBOR scandal is, I guess, on everybody's minds right now. Now, LIBOR stands for London Interbank Overnight Rates. What banks charge when they lend money to each other. Is that correct?
Almost. The O at the end there stands for offered.
Offered, rate. Okay.
It's what the banks offer each other to make these overnight loans.
That sounds kind of parochial. How did that come to affect the world so much?
Well, you know, the way to understand this is that over the last 25 years, the use of credit, of borrowed money, has literally exploded across modern economies in ways that never existed before. You know, we take it for granted now that not only do you borrow money to buy your home, but you also borrow money to buy your car, you borrow money to help your child get to, through a university program. Everybody has multiple credit cards, or nearly everybody does, in their wallets, and we use it for our weekly groceries, literally for a can of soda in the store. And so, since this is also true of corporations who borrow more than ever before and governments that borrow more than ever before, the world was awash, starting in the 1970s, in credit that interposed itself in almost every transaction that people made. And for that reason, the question arose, what will be the charge for the credit? How are we going to determine the interest rate that you pay on your student loan or your credit card or your mortgage? And the way that was worked out was in the kind of clubby arrangements and understandings of the very biggest banks in the world, who are in the end the source of money for just about everybody else who lends money, gets it from these huge global banks. We know them in this country, such as Citibank and Bank of America and J.P. Morgan Chase and Wells Fargo and so on. But they have their counterparts around the world. And because London has been for 200 years sort of the global financial center, what began to happen, and it started around the mid-1980s, was an agreement in which 16 of the largest banks in the world, British, European, American in the main, would regularly be asked by the British Banking Association and by the Bank of England, please tell us your basic rates for the least risky loans you make to one another. And we'll publish that as the LIBOR rate, the London Interbank Offered Rate, so that everybody else will know what the basic cost of money is. And then, depending on where you are in the chain that links these big banks to a loan in Topeka, Kansas, for someone to add a garage to their home, each of those lenders will know how much to add to cover their own profit, because they'll be paying for the money, the LIBOR rate, and they'll be charging a little bit over it. So, in fact, many of the listeners to what I'm saying, if they check the documents on their home loan, their car loan, and so on, they will often see that the rate is, quote-unquote, LIBOR plus 2 or LIBOR plus 3. And what that means is you're paying an interest rate that is a markup over the basic LIBOR rate that the person lending to you or the institution lending to you pays when they get the money.
So what happened? What did the London banks do? Where is the scandal?
The scandal comes as follows, and it really isn't very complicated, although the reporting about it is a mess. It is unfortunately done by an awful lot of people who don't understand what's going on and confuse everybody by printing what they don't understand. But basically, it's quite simple. What the banks did, these huge banks that reported regularly to the authorities in London, was to manipulate what they reported. Instead of reporting accurately what they were actually charging one another, they didn't. They reported something either higher or lower. Now, why would they do that? They did that because these banks that were reporting the interest rates are themselves major holders of securities, loans, all kinds of financial instruments whose value will be higher or lower depending on what the LIBOR rate is. In other words, they stood to gain by making reports, even if those reports, and especially if those reports, were different from what they were actually engaged in. In this country, this would be called a blatant, obvious conflict of interest. You do not rely on the statements of a corporation when you know that those statements will affect how profitable, how secure, how successful that corporation will be, because you understand the basic temptation of any such reporting corporation to say what will advantage it, whether or not that's exactly true. And what we now know, up until recently, it was a widely held speculation. This is not something that anyone didn't know about before. If you understood how interest rates were set around the world, you would know what LIBOR was, and a quick look would teach you how the LIBOR was put together. And then, unless you were very, stupid, there's no way to get around this, you would see right away, there's an opportunity here for the players in the game to be constantly diddling around the rules of the game that they're playing. And so what we suspected has now been confirmed. One of the 16 mega banks, namely Barclays Bank, located and based in England, has admitted systematically and over quite a long period of time, measured in years, systematically misreporting what the interest rates actually were that were being offered between itself and other big banks. They reported a different number to the authorities, which used that number to announce the LIBOR rate. Not only did they admit it, but because they admitted it, they were required to pay, over the recent weeks, fines totaling $450 million to authorities in Britain and the United States as their penalty for what they did. So we don't have to say any more alleged or supposed or concerned. We know that one of these banks did it. And there are now investigations in England and in the United States to determine what else Barclays may have misreported to what other regulatory agencies, which of the other 16 banks were behaving in a similar way, what regulators in England and the United States knew about this, why they did or didn't do something about it, and all the rest. Last point. Everyone listening to this program should understand that every single person who listens is affected by interest rates and how they are set, and that is shaped by LIBOR. So even if you don't yourself have a car loan or a home loan or a student loan or a credit card, every time you shop in a local store, for example, remember that the store owner is himself or herself likely to be borrowing money from a bank or a hedge fund or somewhere, and when they borrow, they pay an interest rate influenced by LIBOR, and that shows up in the price you pay for your shirt, for your car, for your hamburger, or whatever else it is. So we're talking about some of the largest capitalist banks, private banks in the world, systematically feathering their own nest by misrepresenting knowingly what was going on to advantage themselves, and the rest of us live with the consequences, whatever they be, without participating in these decisions, without knowing about these decisions, and simply being damaged in an already hard economic situation by the way these big banks are trying to get their way through the crisis with the least damage to them, no matter what happens to everybody else.
Well, isn't one of the is there a connection with the bankruptcy of major cities? I understand the city of Baltimore is filing a lawsuit, and is Birmingham, Alabama filing a lawsuit? They're going bankrupt along with
And actually closer to you, the state that is now reporting the biggest city bankruptcies is California.
Mm-hmm.
The cities of Vallejo, Stockton, San Bernardino, Mammoth Lakes. Some of these are cities over 200,000 people in population, so you're talking major metropolitan areas. All of those I just mentioned, and they're not the only ones, are either filing bankruptcy or already have filed bankruptcy and are cutting drastically, not just the clerks who work in city offices, but they're laying off teachers, firefighters, police personnel, even the basic services that a civilized society counts on. And part of the problem has been exactly the borrowing of money, which all of these cities do, and the borrowing they did, and the investments in fancy new financial instruments that they have undertaken, particularly in recent years. All of those costs were shaped in part by the LIBOR system. So you can see that the way this system worked, with this very cozy relationship between the so-called regulators in Britain and the United States on the one hand and these enormous banks on the other, turned out to be a cozy relationship that was good for them, but is more or less of a cost and even a disaster for the rest of us.
Hmm. Well, this is Friday Talk Radio, and I'm talking with Richard Wolf about the LIBOR scandal. And if people want to phone in, the number is 503-231-8187. Tell me, how did this spread to Europe? You know, Europe has been in a mess now for I don't know how long. What's the connection there?
Well, in Europe, the mess is, in a sense, more general. People shouldn't get too attached to the specifics of the LIBOR scandal. It is serious. It is global in its impact. I don't want to minimize it, but it is only part of a major, broader breakdown, not just of our financial system, but of capitalism as a global system. In Europe, literally every major country, with the possible exception, and even that's changing, of Germany, is in serious trouble. In the most serious example of a major European country in trouble, we're talking about Spain. Spain is a large economy. The official unemployment rate in Spain now is 25%. That's a rate comparable to the worst rate announced in the Great Depression of the 1930s in the United States. Young people under the age of 30, today report in Spain a 50%, 50, a 50% unemployment rate. You are seeing a society literally collapsing around an economy, an economic system that simply doesn't work. And each time we discover yet another dimension of a capitalism that doesn't function, there are the efforts to say, well, it's just the Spanish, or it's just the banking sector, or it's just this group of people, or it's just this group of regulators asleep at their job. The problem is, if you only had one or two dimensions of the economy not working, that might be a plausible argument. But when you have day after day the LIBOR scandal, the revelation over the last few days that Wells Fargo is paying a $175 million fine for systematically requiring African-American and Latino-American borrowers for mortgages to pay more than they ought to have paid because of the risk they represented to those banks, you can see that especially over the last 5 years of this economic crisis, every major capitalist corporation is basically deciding that we're in for a tough time in this economy, that everybody is on their own, and each of these corporations is doing, if I may quote the famous phrase, whatever is necessary, legal, not so legal, and just plain illegal, to survive. And all of us are discovering that this capitalist system, whose leaders used to tell us what a paragon and what an engine of economic prosperity and growth it is capable, and now we have this 5 years now, is capable of being an engine that not only doesn't deliver the goods, but is dumping one bad after another on us.
Oh, boy. Okay, we have some callers. Let's take the first one. Jack is on the line. Morning, Jack.
Yeah, morning. I have a two-part question. The first question is $450 million enough money, considering the damage they have done to the Western economies? And the second question is, I overheard Matt Taibbi of Rolling Stones magazine say that LIBOR is like the financial sun of our universe. I'll take, and no one, and the Barclays was just one of 16 major banks that was in on this thing. And it's bigger than people could ever imagine. And I'll take your answer off the air. Thank you.
Okay, well.
Good questions, both of them. First question. Making Barclays Bank pay $450 million is the equivalent of fining you, let's imagine you did something wrong, clearly hurtful to a whole lot of people, and the government came down on you, and when it was all over, you had to pay a fine of $1.18. No questions taken. You must pay right now. You would look at me, and you would say, wow, that was a good deal. I was able to do all of that, and the end result is I got to give you $1.18. Barclays is one of the biggest banks in the world. One way to understand how big it is that in 2008, at the peak of the financial collapse in Wall Street, one of the most important things that happened was the bankruptcy and disappearance of Lehman Brothers Bank, one of the largest investment banks in America, an institution that was over a century old. When that bank collapsed, the United States government rushed in and arranged, so that all the effects of it wouldn't be disastrous, to sell a huge portion of the Lehman Brothers to a quote-unquote healthy institution. The leader of the New York Federal Reserve Bank at that time, Timothy Geithner, who's now the Secretary of Treasury in Obama's administration, he led the effort to sell these huge portion of Lehman Brothers Bank to guess who? Barclays Bank. They absorbed Lehman. That's how enormous they are. They do hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars, with a B, every year. For them to pay $450 million is nothing for them.
Chump change.
This is really a detail, and it's clear that they were willing to admit what they did, pay that amount of money, because that would have been a cheap way for them to get this off of the headlines, get this buried. That's obviously what they had hoped for. It hasn't worked out that way for them, but it's not for lack of trying. For your second question, is it an enormous issue? Yes, because literally every interest rate across the world is impacted one way or another, directly or indirectly, by what is done at LIBOR. We do not know, and I don't know what Matt Taibbi said, but we do not know yet how many of the 16 banks that participate in the survey that produces the LIBOR may have done what Barclays did. There are investigations going on now. I think it's reasonable to suppose that the same forces that led Barclays to do this would have been working on every one of those other banks. But until those investigations come up with something, I can't tell you, no one can tell you, who was in on it, who might not have been in on it, but I can assure you that the kinds of pressures on the balance sheets of all of those big banks, all of which, by the way, are in trouble, they include Goldman Sachs, they include Citibank of New York, and so on, these monstrous banks are in all kinds of difficulty, so that the temptation to do the kinds of self-serving misreporting of interest rates that Barclays has now admitted to, the temptation to do that would have been very powerful for all of them. And my guess is we're going to learn that others of them did it as well. But at this moment, we don't know.
Okay, let's go on to our next caller. LJ is on the line. Morning, LJ.
Good morning, Pear. How are you?
Okay.
Good morning, Professor Wolf.
Good morning to you.
Okay, just a quick personal thing. I'm a member of a reading group, and we are using "Capitalism Hits the Fan" as our book for this month. And I want to thank you because your essays are certainly encouraging some very, very heated conversations. So thank you very, very much.
Well, that's why I write them. Thank you for saying so.
Okay. Now, my question is about TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership. I've read a few things about this in the Nation, and I understand it's disguised as a trade agreement, but will have extreme ramifications on the economy. And can you please give us your feelings about that and explain to the folks what's going on here?
Sure. The United States is under, the government of the United States is under continuous pressure from all kinds of industries, our banking industry, but likewise our food industry, grain producing industry, our airline industry, and so on, to compete successfully, to struggle against companies based in other countries who do the same thing pressuring their governments that these companies do in pressuring ours. And sometimes when you have a big company that's active in a number of countries, it mobilizes a number of governments to push. And what they like to do, one of their strategies, not the only one, but one of them, is to organize the arrangement of agreements, treaties, compacts among governments in which the governments promise to open certain kinds of trade, to remove barriers to trade, to cooperate on big projects like dams or opening sea lanes, or changing air flying routes, and so on. And what these arrangements are often favoritisms, ways in which a deal gets made, in this case between the United States and certain other Pacific area nations. These compacts, these agreements, these deals tend to favor in subtle ways the interests of those corporations that were behind pushing them, who got the senator from their state or the congressional representatives from their state to begin pushing the State Department or whoever's in charge to write the agreement, to fill out the clauses of the compact in ways that would give them a leg up, save them some money, create a market for them, make it difficult for their competitor to enter in the same way. These are very common, and they exist in every part of the world. The Pacific is not unique for that. We've been doing that as a nation in Latin America, in Southern America, in Central America, in the Middle East, in Africa, and so on. It has become a normal way of business in the sense that major corporations long ago figured out that they need an active, ongoing, compliant partnership, I'm using the most polite word I can think of, with the top levels of government, and that they can make much more money, much more profit, if they have a close relationship than if they don't. And the Pacific partnership is, again, just another long-developing, subtle, complicated arrangement for that. To know exactly what it's doing, you'd have to be on the inside of all of its negotiations, all of the emails flying back and forth. If they overstep the mark and get caught, then we'll learn, a little bit like we're now learning about the LIBOR scandal. But you can see that the cozy relationship, for example, between those 16 megabanks and the regulatory authorities in New York and in London was enabled them to make huge amounts of money. The LIBOR scandal is the tip of the iceberg, and the articles you referred to in The Nation about the BP thing is the same little window on an old practice that, especially during a time of crisis, gets heated up and whose active members find it awfully easy to cross the line of legality.
Now, aren't trade disputes, wouldn't they be resolved by a sort of a tribunal of attorneys with no recourse by any parties to the agreements?
Well, you might think so, but if there are real trade disputes, they go before the WTO, the World mm-hmm. Trade Organization, which is supposed to do exactly what you just said. The problem is that, once again, the corporations whose well-being, and we're talking about multinational mega-corporations who have huge amounts of money to use to shape what the outcome is. They send, you know, armies of lawyers and economists and accountants wherever in the world these decisions are being made. So when the WTO, for example, begins an investigation, it is bombarded by the lobbying of the corporations that are involved. Those corporations also bring to bear their government leaders. The WTO is necessarily a political institution that is governed in the end by the participating countries. So if you have, you know, GE and GM and Timothy Geithner as Secretary of Treasury all leaning on the WTO, you're going to get outcomes in most cases that are what they want. And if you don't, it's because they were outmaneuvered by another group of businesses and governments who got what they want. But to expect this process to come up with a genuinely neutral decision, let alone one that advantages the mass of people ahead of the cozy deals between big companies and the government, that just flies in the face of everything we know that has happened over the last 50 years.
Okay, let me tell you folks what's coming up this morning on KBOO at 9 on Voices of the Middle East. Gudarz Ekhtadari interviews Professor Mohammed Aman and Professor Nader Hashemi about the recent Egyptian elections and the current struggle between the popular revolution and the military establishment for control of Egypt. At 10, it's Air Cascade with Chris Andre. At 10:15 on Flashpoints, host Dennis Bernstein returns with a look at the findings of the Free Report on the sexual abuse case at Penn State. He also previews a plan of the 99% activists to converge on the Bohemian Grove tomorrow, and the weekly report on occupied Palestine from Nora Barrows Friedman and the Electronic Intifada. At 11, the Digital Divide presents a lecture on what journalism can learn from science. And thank you, KBOO members, for your support. If you're not a member, you can do it by going to kboo.fm and clicking on donate. I'd like a donut. Donate today. Anyway, let's go on to our next caller. Jack is on the line.
Yes, thanks, Per, for having Dr. Wolf with us today. This is really good. I appreciate very much your outlining the condition of these what's widely being referred to now as zombie banks. I'm sure you've heard that term before.
Yeah.
They're so wound up with this massive amount of derivatives, which nobody knows what they're worth, that they're resorting to all kinds of shenanigans to get through. They've been downgraded. Their own credit has been downgraded recently. This was widely reported. And what I'd really like to ask you, though, is what effect does the global banking and the presence or lack thereof of central banks that are run by this global banking cartel have? What is the relationship with the wars we're seeing? For example, what we're seeing ready to break out in Syria, what we saw last year in Libya, where once this NTC gang got in place, even in Benghazi, first thing they did was set up a central bank. And I'd just like to hear your take on the relationship of banking and global wars. And I'll just take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Well, it's a good question. It's a very complicated relationship. First, about central banks, I understand and sympathize with those who want to understand how they work, to understand how central banks impact society, and to do so with a deep suspicion that the way central banks govern, regulate, intervene in economies is not fair, is not taking into account the needs and preferences of the of a democratic majority. All of those things are perfectly reasonable. However, they sometimes take the next step, which is to advocate, in some sense, the end of a central bank. You know, get rid of it, get rid of the Federal Reserve in the United States or the Bank of England. In other words, you're angry at what they do and don't do, and so you obliterate them. The problem then is, in a sense, our history. The reason we have a central bank and the reason why everybody, every advanced country, in fact, every country has a central bank is because if you don't have a central authority governing it, then every little bank is on its own to do whatever it wants as best it can to make money. We had that situation in the United States, and it produced such chaos. So many different money systems, so many irresponsible banks pumping money into the economy, producing wild inflations and so on, that we ended up saying, with all of the pitfalls, we need something to keep a lid on this craziness. And more or less the same history has happened in every other modern country in order to keep some kind of control. But of course, in a capitalist system, if you set up a control mechanism like a central bank, the capitalists don't give up because you've done that. The banks don't give up pushing for their own interests simply because you have a central regulatory authority. They realize, okay, the game has changed. Instead of doing what we want to do to make money on our own, we have to now spend a portion of our money to influence, to shape, to control whatever authority the people of the country set up over us, so we get the kind of quote-unquote regulation we want. And so that's what you get. So now to get to your question. The biggest problem of modern warfare, run by the United States and indeed by most other countries, is that warfare is something that most of the people in most countries don't want. And so for a government to declare a war, to enter a war, to initiate a war, immediately presents it with a problem. And the problem is you're doing something that most people don't want. They don't want to lose their children to become soldiers. They don't want to be bombed. They don't want all those things. They want the government to work things out peacefully because war is awful. Imagine then if a government, despite all of that, not only initiates a war, but goes to its people and says, war, which is not only horrible, is also very expensive. So in order to pay for it, we're going to tax all of you, X dollars, X rupees, X yen, whatever it is, to pay for the war you probably don't want. Well, you know what happens when governments try that? They get overthrown. Because the combination of a war that threatens and a war we don't want to be also a war that we can't afford is simply too much. So what governments do instead, and the United States is a perfect example, is they pay for wars, especially unpopular wars, by not taxing people, and therefore instead they borrow the money. And now you can see why they become interested in the central bank, because when governments borrow money, they have to pay interest. And the more the interest rate, the higher the interest rate, the more expensive the war will be. So there's no coincidence that the two major wars, for example, that the United States is involved in now, the one in Iraq and the one in Afghanistan, that those wars were started, built up, and raged over the last 10 years at a time of record low interest rates, pushed down by the Federal Reserve starting in 2001, 2002, to record lows we haven't seen before, because one of the benefits of that is that the government can borrow money at much lower interest rates than they otherwise would have to pay for these stupefyingly expensive wars. So in a sense, if you understand what I've said, one of the connections is that a central bank, by lowering interest rates, can make warfare cheaper in dollar terms than it would otherwise have been, and that is a very dangerous power to give to a central bank, given that it allows politicians more leeway to choose war as an instrument of policy than they otherwise would dare to do.
Boy, that, you know, that is a great insight, and I really think people should take about a few seconds, just let that sink in, that the low interest rates are making war cheaper. That is something really interesting to think about. We are talking with Richard Wolff, economist and author of Capitalism Hits the Fan and Occupy the Economy. And let's go on to our next caller. Sean is on the line.
Good morning. Good morning. Just think of it. Affordable war.
Exactly. Cut rate wars.
And it's really not funny, but because just reading now that Afghanistan and Iraq together have cost us $1.3 trillion. So my two questions are basically, and I'll take my answer off the air, is could you try to briefly explain why it benefits the IMF and the World Bank for countries like Greece to not go bankrupt, and how it is the United States funds the Euro crash?
Okay, those are big questions. The first one, Greece by itself is a very small economic unit. It accounts for something on the order of 2% of the GDP of all of Europe. It is, therefore, in and of itself, not a big deal, not a big problem. Of course, it's a very big deal and very important for the Greek people going through the kind of awful economic crisis and austerity that they're living through. But in terms of Europe as a whole, let alone the world as a whole, Greece is a very small country. I have to underline that, because when we talk about Spain, as we did a few minutes ago, we're talking about a very, very different situation. Spain is a much, much larger economic factor in Europe and the world than is Greece. So then why is the IMF nonetheless concerned to avoid Greece going bankrupt? Literally, in the sense of refusing to pay its debts and trying to solve its economic problems that way. The answer is that Greece's problems, even though it's a small player in the world, are very similar to the kinds of economic problems that are plaguing many other countries, including very large ones, for example, Spain and Italy, and medium-sized ones such as Ireland and Hungary and so on, so that what the Greeks end up doing will represent an example, a model perhaps to follow for countries who, if they do indeed follow it, would have a much bigger impact. If Italy were to not pay its debts, or if Spain were not to, and so on, then the economic ramifications would overwhelm what the IMF has the resources to deal with now, and it wouldn't even be close. So it becomes extremely important to get the right outcome of all of these troubles in Greece, if only to lessen the chance that a bankruptcy, if it happened in Greece, would become politically what the mass of Spanish or Italian people might also see. Now, let me explain one step further. Bankruptcy is a normal experience of a capitalist economy. today in the United States is courts across this country in every one of our 50 states. Corporations are going bankrupt and going through that procedure in the courts. Individuals are going bankrupt. There is nothing all that strange about this happening. It is part of the way the system works. Governments go bankrupt, either officially or unofficially. 10 years ago, for example, a very important country, Argentina, went bankrupt, refused to pay its debts. So it is interesting that the IMF would now choose not to let a country, in this case Greece, much smaller and therefore without likely to have much less of an impact than Argentina, go through what the IMF permitted Argentina to do. I mean, they didn't like it, they didn't support what the Argentinians did, but they didn't go to anything like the lengths they're going now to prevent it. And the explanation is clear. The IMF understands that, better than anyone, that we are now in the midst of a global capitalist collapse. It's taking many different forms. It's highly uneven. In 2007, 8, and 9, the worst part of the place, the worst part of the crisis, the location, was the United States. The Europeans felt that they were out of the woods. The last two or three years, situation has been in reverse. The Europeans are in great trouble. The Americans think they're doing better. For all those years, places like Brazil and China and Russia felt that they were escaping the whole game, and India. Now those countries are going down the tubes, and it's beginning to come back to the United States. That's why the recovery of the last few months is now over, and the prospects look so grim. So the IMF doesn't want, in this moment of global difficulty, for any country, even one as small as Greece, to take the route of bankruptcy, to basically say to the world's richest people and biggest banks, because those are the only ones that lend to governments in significant amounts of money. So if you declare bankruptcy and you're a government, the people that are going to lose are the banks, the hedge funds, the wealthy individuals who are the only ones who lend to governments around the world. So a bankruptcy has a political punch to it. It is a way of damaging the richest and the wealthiest in a society, and that's why so much effort is devoted to have countries not choose that route.
Okay, let's go on to our next caller. Dan is on the line.
Hello. I want to go back to the original topic. Well, you started out talking about the LIBOR scandal.
Right.
And the falsifying, as I understand it, the falsifying of the interest rates.
Right.
Would it be fair to say that these people were lying? Would lying be the right word?
Seems to me that if you knowingly tell somebody something different from what you know to be the truth, that it would be hard to come up with any other appropriate word.
Yeah.
They hate to say the word, so they use phrases like manipulating the interest rate. Yes. The bottom line is, you're quite right. They reported one thing, and it was not what they knew to be the case.
Okay, well, we know what that is. Well, that's why my main point, the main reason I called, is I want to bring up this issue of the morals of the individual people. And this applies equally to the 2008 crisis that, you know, we're always talking about and we're still living with the results of. And it seems to me that there's not enough focus that is the cause of these things, and that the individual people should be punished. You mentioned about the fine, you said it wasn't a large fine that they were given. It sounded to me like it was given to the institution. I think it would be much more effective if individual human beings with names, you know, did these things. It wasn't an institution that did these things. It was people. And I have a wonderful quote here about character in banking. This whole idea of human character as the source of the problem. And this is from the famous banker J.P. Morgan from the late 1800s and early 1900s. So whatever you think of him, you know, good or bad or whatever, he was definitely one of the most experienced bankers and one of the most influential ones in the history of the financing. And he was being interviewed by a congressional committee. And here's a, I'll just tell you a pair. This is very brief. But if I could just read, there are two questions and two answers in the interview that they're giving him.
Okay, real brief.
Yeah, yeah, but it's good. Okay, they're just like one sentence things. So the question, the question is from the Congress, probably a congressman, and then the answer is from J.P. Morgan, the banker. Question: is not commercial credit based primarily upon money or property? Answer: no, sir. The first thing is character. Question: before money or property? Answer: before money or anything else. Money cannot buy it. A man I do not trust could not get money from me on all the bonds in Christendom. End quote. And so that's my point is, you know, and we hear about this idea of trust. If you can't trust people, if you can't trust bankers, if you can't, you know, it's going to gum up the whole system. And so I have a question for the for your guest there,
mm-hmm.
or two questions. Because I think this one is that I would like him to define the term moral hazard, which I think should be in all our vocabulary, but it's just been totally neglected pretty
much. Okay, that was the next question.
The second question is, I know from what I've heard of him speak before, he criticizes capitalism, and I think he's an advocate of socialism. What form? I don't know. There's so many different kinds. I don't know. But my point, my question is, whatever system you have, if the people that are running it, say your socialist system, whatever it is that you want, if they are if the people running your socialist system, if their personal character, if they're dishonest, immoral, unethical, and stupid people, well, how's that going to work out for you? I don't care what system.
Okay, let's go on with that. My quick answer would be power corrupts, but let's see what Professor Wolf has to say.
Well, I understand the question. It is correct that there were people who made key decisions. The two chief executives of Barclays Bank, which is the one bank that has admitted publicly that it lied, that it misrepresented what these LIBOR rates should have been, those two individuals have resigned from Barclays Bank. And the one who's most famous, the guy who was really in charge, a man named Robert Diamond, who was originally an American citizen and moved over there. And not only has he resigned his job as the head of Barclays Bank, but he has given up this year's bonus. But before you cry for him, be aware that he began his job as the head of Barclays Bank in 2006. And until this moment, he has so far been paid, according to the newspapers, 98 billion pounds. That would be $150 million. And I did a little bit of arithmetic, and that means over the last 6 months, the last 6 years, he earned a weekly income of $500,000 every week for the last 6 years. So you can see that even if his bank pays the fine, and even if he loses his job, he doesn't have to worry if he never gets another job in the rest of his life, given the amount of money that he has already accumulated. So you are not doing anything so far that would dissuade the next person who replaces Mr. Diamond from making the roughly the same decisions. Having said that, you can have an economic system that encourages, provides incentives, and rewards dishonest behavior, or you cannot. I understand in the end it'll always be a question of how decent a human being is, but we will get a better result if we genuinely provide minimal incentives for corruption and dishonesty and minimal rewards for doing so. We don't have a system like that. If you talk to any banker in a large bank anywhere across the world, and I'm talking to you from Manhattan, lower Manhattan where I live and where I interact with bankers all the time, they will tell you, even before they have a couple of beers, that theirs is a rat race, that theirs is a shark tank. Those are the words they use. They are required to keep their jobs in a bank to do everything and anything necessary so that their part of the bank, whatever it is, shows a positive profit every quarter, year in and year out. That if they don't, they are fired. They have no job security. They do not belong to any union. They have nothing but their ability to make that bottom line look good. Well, under such a circumstance, you will have to have an extraordinary level of personal character and willing to pay for it by losing your job if you don't do what all the other bankers around you that you have lunch with every day are telling you about what they're doing to make sure they keep their jobs. One of the reasons I'm critical of capitalism is simply that it is a system that systematically creates the incentives and provides the rewards for the behavior we're then supposed to be shocked to discover is going on, and I think that's unwise of us. I don't claim that I can, in the end, shape or control a man or a woman's character, but we can do an awful lot to make it unlikely, or at least less likely, to get the kinds of massive, dishonest behaviors that we see around us. And again, let me pick an example close to you. In California, where Wells Fargo, yesterday or the day before, one of the biggest banks in your area, admitted to basically acting in such a way as to charge African-American and Latino-American people borrowing money for their homes more money than they should have been charged given the amount of risk they represented, and that their non-Hispanic and non-African-American counterparts were being asked to pay. You can claim you didn't know anything about it, but once you understand how Wells Fargo rewarded the people they did business with and their own bankers, it isn't very hard to figure out why these people took advantage of the situation in our country to squeeze a bit more money out of these people than they ought to have. And as long as we allow this kind of private money to sit in the hands of these bankers, they will either rewrite the law or go around the law, pay the people they need to learn how to do that effectively, and so we will be constantly catching them years and years after they do this sort of thing, until we realize that you do have to question the system, you do have to change the system. Otherwise, even if you punish the individuals, the next set of people in their place will do the same.
Okay, let's see if we can get a couple more calls in. Who's on next? Brian is on next.
Hey, hi, Bear.
Okay.
Nice to hear your favorite economist here. Yes, sir. I have a couple of quick questions. What do you think of the current credit bureau system? To me, there's got to be something done about that because it's crippling people like me. I got sick and almost died with insurance a few years ago. I had a successful business of 12 years, and you know, I got bankrupted by the medical bills, just continuing medical bills. And now, you know, you try to restart the business with nothing. I mean, I've got to come up with the ideas myself and the money, which is almost impossible. But it seems to me totally unforgiving. It's also incompetent if you've ever tried dealing with them. And it's, I think if there's some way it could be regionalized and supervised by states, but then I'm an economic nincompoop, so I'd like to hear your take on that. And question two, do you think the language of economics is deliberately written obscurely so that the likes of me can't understand a word of it? And I'll take your answer off the air. Thank you.
Okay.
Very quickly. The answer to your second question is absolutely. Economics, and let me be real clear with you. I've been a professor of economics all my adult life. That's what I do. So I'm talking about my own profession, my colleagues, my friends and associates. Yes, we long ago tried to copy what lawyers did, namely, to take fundamentally simple ideas that anybody can understand, rewrite them into a language that nobody but initiates and trained people can understand. And we did that for the same reasons lawyers do, to be able to charge the average people in this society a fat fee to translate our gobbledygook back into the original simple ideas that everybody can understand. If we never developed that language, you'd never pay us to translate them because you'd understand what it was at stake. It's an awful reality, but there is no honest way to deny that that's what's going on, number one. Number two, to deal with your credit problems and those of so many other Americans, which is absolutely reasonable, you'd have to have a reasonable system in which, for example, your experience with the medical profession would be taken into account, given that we have an out-of-control medical system in this country. You know, Americans pay twice as much as anybody else for medical care, and the results of our medical care are no better than the average in the rest of the world. And so something is terribly wrong, and the insurance doesn't pay for it, and the hospitals overcharge, and the drug companies do. It is a scandal. So it becomes compounding if you can't get credit because you've been victimized by an out-of-control medical system. A reasonable change of system in this country, which would include the national health care that every other advanced industrial country provides for its people, would never have put you in that position in the first place. But you can't go to the credit companies and say, you should ignore the extortion of your income that the medical profession did. You have to have a systematic change. You can't ask one sector or another to make the change without all the others. That's why I'm against scapegoating and blaming this or that sector, and why I end up being a critic of capitalism, because system change is the only way to solve these problems, including your credit problem.
Okay, we got time for one last question. Do we have a caller? Do we have John? Make it quick.
Professor Wolf, I've purchased your Capitalism Hits the Fan CD from Alternative Radio like 3 times and given it to different people. I've got the DVD. My question is, why do you see small business as a possible center of revolutionary activity? 80 years ago this month, the Nazi Party came to power in Germany.
Well, we only have about a minute left for him to answer that, so.
Okay.
Small business.
It's not small business that I am an advocate of. It is a different way of organizing business, small, medium, or large. I'm basically a Democrat, with a small d, not a party person. I believe in democracy. I think, with all of its warts and problems, it's the best way. But because I believe in democracy, I believe it belongs in the place most of us as adults spend most of our life, at work. It belongs in the job, in the enterprise, at the workplace. If the mass of people were involved not only in making the goods and services, but in making the decisions as directors, what to produce, how to produce, where to produce, and what to do with the profits, then we would finally have transparency, because so many of us would be involved in these decisions, we wouldn't be at the beck and call, at the mercy of the decisions now made by major shareholders and boards of directors that have brought capitalism into this dead end. I want is a different organization of enterprises, not a preference of little ones over big ones or middle-sized ones. That's the important thing, to democratize the economy as a way forward that would really be different from what we have now, a post-capitalist system that might free us from the cascading problems of this capitalist system that simply no longer works.
Okay, thank you very much. I think we're going to have to end there. Thank you very much, Richard Wolf.